accession number 31509, Reel 2.
I always say nine. I was in my ninth year because I had my ninth birthday after I arrived.
If I could just introduce it, it's Gavin Douglas, and we're on Reel 2 now. So when did you come back to the UK, Douglas? Gavin, rather?
We came back to the UK in 1923. I suppose it was around about the middle of the summer. The only recollection I really have of the voyage is, apart from the delight a small boy has in running around the decks and all that sort of thing, but the thing that stuck out in my mind, which was very exciting, is that when we were anchored off Aden for a few hours, and where also the ship took some more coal aboard, some of the ship's crew, I think the kitchen staff, slung a meat hook with a large lump of pork on the end of it over the side because there were sharks cruising around. And they hooked a shark, and it swallowed the thing whole right down to its stomach, into its stomach, and they were able to put it up the ship's side onto the tween decks between the forecastle in the front of the vessel and the bridge. And there was a huge fish, huge to me anyway, slapping around on the deck, acting very dangerously. The ship's doctor had a long knife, and he was trying to stab it every now and again, very inaccurately, to kill it. It took a long time to stop moving. The only other thing I really remember about the voyage, I don't remember ever being seasick or anything like that, it must have been a pretty smooth voyage, was when we arrived at Tilbury in London, and it was dark. It was early in the evening because, which gives a point to the fact that it was probably nearer the autumn, the end of the summer, because it wouldn't be dark otherwise, and I wouldn't be up at that hour. We happened to foul the mooring lines of a lighter and dragged it underwater, and it sank. There was nobody on board, and I don't know what happened after that, because we disembarked and we went into one of the London hotels, I think a railway hotel, and if any, it was probably the hotel, which is still a railway hotel, near I know the name as well as I know my own. I can't think of it at the moment.
Charing Cross, would it be? There's a big hotel there, isn't
it
there?
It was indeed the Charing Cross. I was just having a seen a moment, couldn't remember the name. The food there tasted, it's not a hotel remarkable for its food, but it tasted so delicious after ship's food of those days, which was adequate and one used to, but even boiled eggs tasted better. Of course, they were fresher than they would have been on the ships which were plying in the Far East and for a long time. From there we moved down to stay with some friends who had a farm on the coast of Essex, a place called Rabnest, which is not far from Colchester, and we spent the rest of the summer there whilst my father looked around for somewhere to live. But he had to go back to China, and he rented a house for us in Falmouth in Cornwall, primarily because he thought the climate would be kinder to us, having been many years out east, and my brother and sister never having been anywhere out east. They were both born after I was born 5 years later. My mother took the chance that time, and also it was just after the end, or the end after the end of the war, and there was no way she could get back to England to have either of them. And they survived perfectly well, so that was why they didn't. They were both born in China, one in Hong Kong and one in Tientsin. In Falmouth, I went to a prep school called Belmont, about 30 or 40 boys, and they were boys who seemed to me now, looking back, were the children of your doctor, and quite a few of them must have had parents who came from overseas. There were one or two group photographs I have. One of the boys called Harris definitely showed an Oriental cast to his features. But one didn't think of those things in those days. Children were children, and it didn't matter whether they were white, black, or khaki. They were friends or not friends, just depending on their personalities and how they clashed or didn't clash with one's own. It was like all schools in those days, not a very happy sort of thing, although I was only a day boy. It was run by a dragon of a Scottish woman called Miss Crawford, and there was one other teacher who was a horrible person, wore violet clothes all the time and very mean looking, and she liked to punish us by hitting us on the palms of our hands or the back of our hands with a ruler, not the flat side up, but with the edge, which was very painful. Fortunately, we had one spring an epidemic which closed the school for several months. It started off with whooping cough, and then it went on to mumps and various other things. And of course, my education had to continue. And my mother found and employed a wonderful woman called Miss Boileau, who was a retired teacher, who took me through my early education and gave me, in a matter of 4 or 5 months, took me far ahead of boys of my own age who had gone to school in England, because I was having all this personal attention. So the result was that later, when I went to a public school, still in the lower part of the public school, I was well ahead of all the boys of my age.
Which public school did you go to?
It was a very small public school. It was founded in the Queen Elizabeth's reign. And it was in the Channel Islands when we moved to Guernsey to live. This was in about after we'd been in Cornwall for about a year to a year and a half. My father, in the meantime, had decided that Guernsey would be a very suitable place. Now, the reason for that was that we're now talking about 1924-25, and it was just before the general strike of 1926. And in the foreign newspapers, English newspapers, all this was being reported, how the trade unions and that were taking over completely. And it looked as though we were going to have what the French had had a century earlier, a civil war. That was the way they painted it. My father did not want us to be left in England at the mercy of the mob, so to speak, and he decided that Guernsey would be safe enough to leave us where there wouldn't be any of this trouble. As you will know, the general strike only lasted about 11 days, but it was a general strike called by the Trades Union Congress, and everybody went on strike. You couldn't move or anything, and there were many volunteers from amongst people to drive buses and to try and keep some sort of movement going on, so that things could, but it was very bad, and it didn't come to open warfare or anything that sort of, which is almost how it was sort of looked at from the Far East. But it was a pretty close thing. But anyway, by that time we were in Guernsey and quite safe, and see, where am I now?
You were at public school at Queen Elizabeth.
Elizabeth College. Now, Queen Elizabeth College was founded in 1578, I think, or something like that. And it was a small school, and it catered mainly for boys whose parents were overseas. There was another similar public school called Victoria College in Jersey, and it was the same thing. We were all expatriate children being brought up at a public school in a more equitable climate for people who have been out east for a long time than would be available, say, even in the south of England. It wouldn't be much difference, but there was an element of safety. And they catered, especially advertised widely in the Eastern papers, for children of parents who were working abroad. So there was a kind of a link for everybody. There were boys from Guernsey, very good, a lot of good Guernsey families. It had a high standard as an educational institution, and well up with the best of the English public schools. It had a lot of day boys, but those were people who had relations in Guernsey, who were looking after nephews and nieces, or the sons and daughters. There was also another school called the Ladies' College for girls, rather like the Ladies' College at Cheltenham. Anyway, it was a good school. The education was as good as anywhere in amongst the private schools. And I was very happy there. Very high-spirited. Always getting into trouble because boys would bet me to do something that they wouldn't do themselves. And I, like an idiot, took up the bet and generally got caught. But otherwise, it was like any other school.
Did you know what you wanted to do when you left school?
Oh, no, there was no doubt about it. I wanted to go into the army. Always, I got over wanting to be a engine driver or something like that, a railway engine driver, but I wanted to go into the army. And one of the things that reinforced that was that the Channel Islands, Guernsey we'll talk about particularly, always had a British infantry regiment based there, had been for centuries. And I can remember the first regiment that was there when I first got there was the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, known as the DCLI. And we, as boys, always had to attend church en masse at 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings. And of course, the regiment always used to send down a large detachment, which practically filled a small church in town, of the soldiers for the morning service. They would come marching down with the band leading, and they came down, the awful clatter of the bayonets which they were wearing, strangely enough, as they sat down on the wooden pews, and they got up and shuffling the heavy boots and all that sort of thing. After the service was over, of course, very vigorous army service. They would parade outside and they would all march off back to the fort, which is about a mile and a half, 2 miles from the church, with the band leading. And as a small boy, I used to walk along with them for some time because martial music really stirred me. And all these chaps in their uniforms and that sort of thing, I thought the army is a place for me. Well, it maybe was in my blood too, because way back into the 14th century, 13th century, all my ancestors were fighting men. They were on the side of Robert the Bruce, dealing with King Edward I's wishes to colonize Scotland, as he had done Wales. And we were involved for 300 or 400 years with wars of now called of Scottish independence. So I think probably in my blood there was this feeling of wanting to protect my country. And one of the ways to do it was to be in one of the services, which is why I went into the army.
So did you go in as a cadet? No, would you have been at school? Did you have a cadet force?
We had what was called the OTC, the Officer Training Corps. And of course, as soon as we had two institutions. For the younger boys, when you first started, you became a Sea Scout, which was, of course, as you know, a branch of the Boy Scouts. Being a Channel Island, of course, Sea Scout was more apposite in a way. We had a small cutter we used to row. We learned how to tie knots and all those sort of things. But that was only to keep us busy on Tuesday afternoons, which was a half day. And on Tuesday afternoons, the OTC, we took boys in from about 13 years of age onwards, until they left school. Well, this was fun. It was like playing at soldiers, and of course we had two army officers, ex-army officers, teachers, Captain Cole and the Captain Le Cheminot, and we used to, they used to run the school OTC as though we were in a regiment. We also took military exams, what was called Certificate A. You had to do a certain amount, put answers down on paper to various tactical exercises of this sort. And this, of course, was something that was very valuable to both in the way of getting marks when you eventually went to Sandhurst, and also sort of taught one something about basic, which was very necessary for anybody who was going to go into the services.
So that was a good basis, would you say, Gavin, being in the OTC, for going later into the army? It gave you a good basis.
I think it was more than that. I think it was good for everybody, because it taught about military discipline and responsibility. Many of the boys hated being in the OTC. Those the prickly uniforms which we had to wear, chafed your neck and that sort of thing. And but if they were sloppy, they were treated just as if they were in the army and told off. And I think it was an excellent institution. Well, boys do need a certain amount of a lot of discipline, and it doesn't have to be brutal, but it teaches them to conform.
So when did it come up, you know, the time for you to go in the army, to apply to the army?
I think it was all in my mind that if I could pass into Sandhurst taking the army entrance exam, I would do so. And it was done through the school, of course. Boys, when they were going, they would produce a certain number of army cadets who said they would like to go to Sandhurst, and we then had to go and sit the common service exam, which were held in London I know the name as well, I know my own.
Yes, well, not to worry, it was in London.
Burlington House.
Wellington House, right.
Burlington.
Burlington House, yes. Right.
And there we had a lot of mostly the usual subjects. If you wanted to go into to Woolwich, which dealt with the more technical side, like engineers and gunners, you had to take higher tests in mathematics and the science subjects. Or if you wanted to go into Sandhurst, you took lower maths instead of higher maths, and you had to take a foreign language, of course, which was always French, and history, and various military subjects.
Which one did you take?
I decided for Sandhurst, because I was going to go into the army as a regimental officer. It was only when I was at Sandhurst that I decided which branch of the army I was going to go into, which was the cavalry. Now, until I went to Sandhurst, I'd never sat on a horse in my life. Funnily enough, in China, you don't see many horses except rather poor little screws, and it's not the rice paddies and all that. It's not a country that lends itself to horsemen until you get out into the prairies of Mongolia and things like that. So, and in Guernsey, of course, it would be a tiny little island. There were very few horses. I was put into the lowest ride of all, and I liked riding so much that I was promoted in the 18 months of the Sandhurst course from the lowest ride to the top ride. I gave up most of my sports, which I'd excelled at. I'd been captain of cricket, captain of soccer, captain of hockey, and boxing at school, captain of all those things, because A, I was quite good at it. Of course, it was a small school, and there wasn't all that competition. But Sandhurst, as I just said, riding, so became my greatest pleasure. Not only the equitation classes which we had during the school day, but in the afternoons and on holidays and spare time, I used to hire a horse from nearby livery stables and spent hours on a piece of ground behind Sandhurst called Barossa, where I could practice my riding and jumping.
I suppose at that time, this would have been the 1930s, it would have been expected that the cavalry would have been useful in another war.
Oh, absolutely, is that right? Yes.
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 It proved not to be, I think. Is that right?
You can't put a horse against a tank. In that respect, it's absolutely right. But there were certain areas of the world, as you know, we were, at that time, half the world was painted pink in the atlases, and there were places where horses were very necessary. In the Indian Army particularly, there were 21 cavalry regiments, all horsed. And that was where I eventually went. And also, in England, of course, there were a dozen or so cavalry regiments, but they were, again, they would take it in turn. Three or four of them would always be overseas. They would be in, at least two or three would be in India, there'd be one or two in Egypt, just as an example.
So what you're saying is the cavalry was still relevant.
It was still
in, yes.
Yes, it was still a valid arm. Quite apart from the fact it was very useful for decorational purposes at showing the might of the British Empire. My father had a saying, which he was always saying, if God had meant us to walk, he would have given us four legs, but as he didn't, we only get two, and horses have four legs, obviously he meant us to ride. And he knew living in a cavalry regiment was more expensive for a young officer than living in most British regiments, infantry regiments. And I found out at Sandhurst that it was more easy to live on one's pay with a small allowance in the Indian cavalry than it would be to be living in London in the Shire somewhere and not only having to pay one's expensive mess bills for entertaining and all that sort of thing. And in any case, I mean, we did go into a British cavalry regiment. There was no saying that I wouldn't be shot out to India in any case. And another encouragement for British officers leaving, or cadets to stand up to go to the Indian Army, was that it was better paid and the pensions were better. So a lot of people, for that reason alone, and of course there were the others whose parents, grandparents, great-grandparents had served in India and they felt an affinity and they went out there to join these regiments. Well, of course, they were welcomed by the regiment institutions because of the continuity of family service in the same regiment, and this was very much appreciated. One person, such person I knew very well in those days, who sent us, it was Peter Rattray. Peter's grandfather founded Rattray's Sikhs. So Rattray went out to India and did his 1 year with the British regiment, as we all had to learn something of the language and also something of what it was like to live in India, and decided whether or not we could hack it or we hated it and could still stay with British service. But Rattray did the same as I did. We all were called unattached list Indian Army officers. We were attached to a British regiment for 1 year, at the end of which we were posted to the regiment of our choice. You were given three choices, and usually you got one. And in that year, you obviously visited the regiment. You were allowed leave to go up and be interviewed by the colonel, who would decide whether or not you would fit in with his regiment. And you, in due course, received your instructions from Army headquarters in India a month or so before your year was up, saying, on such and such a date, you will proceed to whatever regiment it was and whichever part of India it was. So we had a choice of regiments. Very few didn't get their first choice. Some didn't because too many people wanted to go to one regiment, so the military executive branch posted you somewhere else. And that was sometimes a bit of a disappointment. But once you were in the regiment, it was nothing.
Which regiment did you join, Gavin?
When I arrived in India, I was posted to the Royal Norfolk Regiment. It wasn't the Royal Norfolks when I arrived, but it became the Royal Norfolks during my year with them, granted by the monarch at that time, as King George V. And, of course, it was a big thing to become a Royal Regiment. They had to change all their facings from primrose yellow to royal blue, as all the regiments did, had a royal title. And they were a county regiment. The Norfolks very much a county regiment. Most of the officers came from East Anglia, particularly Norfolk, and so did the men. So therefore, it was a cosy family type of regiment. Very efficient, very good at games. The Norfolk soccer team beat most other regiment soccer teams in the sort of leagues, so to speak, that were arranged with other regiments in different areas of India, and they were good at boxing. The officers, some of them, about a half a dozen, also played polo, which was useful to me as I was going to go into a carrier regiment, and I had a young pony which I bought, and on which I learnt my first strokes of polo and slow games of polo before I actually joined my regiment.
Yes, one thinks of polo in India. One sees pictures of a lot of polo activity.
Polo in India, after all, polo was first founded out east. There's some slight argument as well, founded up in Kyrgyzstan, in the steppes of Russia, or whether the Persians brought it in. And of course, the early Mughals were all descendants of invading Caucasian forces that had come in from the west over the various passes, and they were horse races, and so horse was a very important thing in India, and very good horses they were. They were especially bred for these purposes.